Ave Maria in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. Welcome to Ave Maria in the Afternoon, examining the world through the lens of faith from the heart of the Church to help us navigate the culture. Here's Dr. Marcus Peter.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much for joining us on this hour of Ave Maria in the Afternoon. I'm Marcus Peter. So blessed to be with all of you. We're going to begin this hour by talking with my friend Dr. Gregory Popchick. A new survey by Catholic TV suggests widespread emotional distress amongst U.S. Catholics. And that raises the question about how mental health may shape parish life and mass attendance. Now, Greg and Lisa Popchick are two of the few people within the entire psychological sphere that have a very deeply integrated, holistic view of the psyche of the human person as it pertains to your spiritual life. And between the two of them, Ray Guarendi and a few others, we are seeing a real recognition of the fact that there is a need for an integrated, continued formation of the human person. And so Greg is going to join us today to talk about the kind of mental health issues that might be faced at the parish level and whether or not those can really impact parish involvement and mass attendance and parish life in general. After that, I want to talk about the issue pertaining to Lindsay Clancy's trial. Social media is abuzz following her trial. I've been rather heartbroken to see what's been going on. So this is a mother who's been admitted, who has admitted to murdering her three young children. This was in January of 2023. She was in a state of postpartum depression, and she was being medicated, but the reports are conflicting about how the medication was affecting her. Now, what I want to point out about all this is we still have insufficient information to draw intellectual conclusions. And we are not intimately acquainted with the case, no matter how much we try to read up. The fact of the matter is there are other people who are directly connected to it. However, thousands of people online are rushing to her defense, accusing her ex-husband even of committing the murders themselves and framing her. And thousands of others are calling her a monster who deserves nothing less than execution. I want to talk about this reality of feeding the conspiratorial echo chambers and what it does to our souls. And I want to hopefully try to pull us back to prudent sanity in Christ, his scriptures, and his magisterium. And then finally, for the remainder of the hour, we will talk with David Pinault about Islamist persecution, Christian survival, and encountering the Houthis in Yemen. For now, the headlines.
Thank you, Marcus, and good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Tuesday, August 18th. It's the Feast of St. Helena. And today's news is brought to you by Ave Maria Family of Funds at AveMariaFunds.com. President Trump says there's no talks with Iran currently happening or planned. Trump posted on Truth Social this morning saying the U.S. naval blockade in the Strait of Hormuz remains in full force and effect. He noted the strait is open and operating. Three states are holding primaries Tuesday. Races for the House, Senate, and for governor are being held in Alaska, Wyoming, and Florida, where a crowded field of GOP candidates hope to replace term-limited Governor Ron DeSantis. Several Democrats are also running. The landmark trial against Meta is underway inside a federal courthouse in Oakland, California. Colorado, Kentucky, New Jersey, and California are seeking $1.4 trillion in damages and allege the company engineered Facebook and Instagram to make it addictive to children. In her opening statement, California Deputy Attorney General Megan O'Neill said Meta told Congress and parents that Instagram and Facebook were safe for kids while it hid the truth. And the man behind ESPN is dead. William Rasmussen, whose traffic jam brainstorm with his son helped launch the start of 24-hour-a-day sports coverage, passed away today at the age of 93 of complications from Parkinson's disease. The broadcaster-turned-entrepreneur is being remembered for his optimism and love of innovation through technology and creative programming. From the AveMariaRadio.net news desk, I'm Dan McGraw.
Good afternoon. Welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. As is the case every week, my friend Dr. Gregory Popchek generously joins us with his time and his talents. Greg is no stranger to this program. He and his bride co-host Mortal Life on EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network and Ave Maria Radio. They also are the creators of the Catholic Households on Mission, HOM, app and network. And we talk about questions pertaining to mental health in the Catholic Church. A new Catholic TV survey suggests widespread emotional distress amongst U.S. Catholics. And that raises questions about how Christians tackle the question of mental health as Christians, but also as an institutional church. Greg, thank you for joining us. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's always a joy to connect with you. And you and I have talked about this before. There's a tendency amongst very faithful Christians to sidestep questions pertaining to legitimate mental health needs and concerns. Would you please share with us why this tendency amongst faithful Christians?
Sure, and I think this is a common problem that we run into both on the show, More to Life, and through our pastoral counseling practice at CatholicCounselors.com. But the technical term for what you're describing is spiritual bypassing. And it's the idea that I should be able to pray this problem away, or if I was just a faithful enough Christian, I wouldn't have this problem in the first place. We believe that somehow grace is meant to just make these things magically disappear. The metaphor I like to use with our clients through CatholicCounselors.com or through the radio program, though, is that if we imagine that we were a car, grace would be the fuel that we put in the tank. So the sacraments, the prayers that we say, the spiritual practices that we engage in fill our tank with really good fuel, high octane, if you will. But if we have a full tank of great gas but four flat tires, we're still not going anywhere. You know, if we have a full tank of gas and a cracked engine block, we're still not going anywhere. As St. Thomas Aquinas put it, grace builds on nature, right? It doesn't supplant it. And so because of that, we have to give God something good to work with. And of course, God is constantly calling us to healing and working in our lives to heal us, but he gives us earthly means through medical practice and psychological practice to make sure that we are a well-honed, well-tuned instrument to be used in God's hands to do his work. And so that means that even if I am the most faithful Catholic person, the most devout and sincere Catholic faithful individual, I'm still going to need to do work on my emotional health, my relational health, and my physical well-being too.
You bring up a crucial point about the fact that God doesn't destroy our nature. He wants to build it and perfect it. Grace builds upon that nature. To that end, I also want to invite you to speak to the fact that we've gotten really good, especially in science, about the physical type of medicine. But the avenue of mental health and, you know, anywhere from proper research to strategies, there's still a tremendous amount of work that needs to be done and corrected too. You know, people like you and your bride are helping bring that spiritual corrective to where the avenue has gone astray.
Yes, thank you for that. And I think that's a big focus of our work. How do we interpret the empirical insights from contemporary counseling psychology through the lens of faith so that people don't feel like they have to betray their faith and beliefs and values to become mentally healthy? Because you don't. In fact, there's a lot of overlap between what the science, what the psychological sciences say about what leads to a healthy functioning person and relationship and what the Catholic Church teaches about the same. And so a lot of our work is really guided by St. John Paul's theology of the body, which St. John Paul said was his attempt to promote a comprehensive view of the person. Like, what does it mean to be a flourishing human person in healthy, holy relationships? And a lot of we've not run into a case where it's not, is supported directly by psychological science and research. And so it's our job as Catholic counselors and my team at CatholicCounselors.com to really interpret that information through that lens of faith so that we can give people the best of both worlds. You know, going back to this study for a second, you know, the study that you mentioned found that in a representative sample of almost 1,600 Catholics, 69% report chronic fatigue, 66% struggle with sleep, 55% have recently felt hopeless about something. 86% say that faith is central to their lives, but up to a third of Catholics have even thought about self-harm in the last few months. So this is a significant challenge that we are facing. And unfortunately, a separate study by Pew Research found that over 70% of priests don't feel that they've got the adequate training to deal with even the most common problems that their parishioners bring to them, because their preparation is mostly sacramental and liturgical, but it's not pastoral in the sense of kind of pastoral psychology. And so there's a lot of work that the church needs to do in this area. In fact, I don't want to go on too long here, but it dovetails well with my dissertation research that I did in 2005 that looked at nationally Catholic versus Protestant perceptions of the adequacy of local and church-based mental health services. And it found that although Catholics and Protestants, faithful Catholics and Protestants both value faith-based options over secular options, Catholics are much less satisfied with the options that are available to them than their Protestant counterparts are. And also Catholics in our study said that they wanted 17 different competencies in their counselors than Protestant counselors have. So where Protestants tend to view or want counselors who were educated in biblical approaches to some problems, Catholics wanted counselors who were up to date with the most recent psychological, secular approaches to treatment, but could also integrate their Catholic faith into that. And so we want a much more holistic approach to counseling than many evangelical Christians especially.
In other words, the expectation, especially amongst Catholics, for mental health needs is a lot higher, which that can correspond to a lot of reasons that you've shared about in the past, but also just shared. This also seems to tie in with a lot of the CDC studies that you and I have spoken about in the past, which is, you know, rising depression and anxiety rates that we're seeing, even amongst people who don't have a religious outlook of life. So we're seeing a similar pattern happen within the church. Can you please comment on how, therefore, the Catholic institutional church needs to have a better response to this?
Yeah, I mean, I think we need to recognize that this, you know, that emotional problems, relationship problems, mental health problems are not something that only a small percentage of people experience. Upwards of 30% of adults will experience some form of depression, anxiety, mental health problems, relationship problems in any given year. And that's a huge number, especially when you talk about the number of Catholics. And we are not really responding adequately to that. You know, that's really the mission of CatholicCounselors.com, our ministry. But it's a challenge because, as I was just sharing, Catholics really want a professional who is capable of interpreting the most recent empirical insights from counseling psychology through that lens of Catholic spirituality and theology. And there really aren't any organizations training people how to do that. You know, so we work very hard to make sure that any counselor I hire goes through a period of formation before they would see their first client that could last, you know, 6 months or more, where we're doing reading, weekly discussion, case conversations. And I want to make sure that all of our people are really grounded both in the psychological research and the Catholic theology so that we can really provide that to folks. But I'm not aware of any other programs, academic or otherwise, that do that. Now, there's an organization, the Association for Clinical Pastoral Education, which is responsible for certifying hospital chaplains. And more recently, they've taken over the training of pastoral counselors in general. Mm-hmm. But I think there are maybe six Catholic, well, maybe a dozen Catholic members, and my team are all of them, you know, essentially. So, you know, which is not to say that other people aren't doing good work. I don't mean to imply that. Yeah. But I'm saying that for the most part, it's self-styled, right? It's I'm a faithful Catholic counselor who wants to do counseling, so I'm going to kind of put it together in my own way, which is fine as far as it goes, but we want to make sure that we're really using as research-based approaches to integrating faith and counseling as possible. And there is actually a lot of good research that talks about how to do it well, but I'm not convinced that there are a lot of Catholic professionals who are trained in that.
We're down to under a minute left in the segment, Greg. So for parents listening, but also just generally anyone listening, everyone's aware of the mental health crises of the modern man, let alone the modern churchgoer. Can you please say a few words of exhortation, but also to plug some of the great work you're doing?
Well, thank you. That's very kind. And I have to say, you know, look, if you're suffering, one thing that we know as Catholics is that suffering is part of life, right? And it's an inescapable part of life. And that, in fact, God, we are privileged as Catholic Christians to cooperate with God to bring healing to suffering, to bring peace out of chaos, to bring order out of misery and suffering. And so getting the best tools available to us is really critical to our spiritual journey as well. So if you are suffering in your relationships, in your emotional life, in your mental health, that's nothing to be ashamed of. That's to embrace that, to recognize it, and to open yourself up to the healing that God wants to give you is exactly what he's calling all of his children to do, so that he can build on that nature and give you the healing to your body, mind, and spirit that we all long for.
My guest has been Dr. Gregory Popchick. He and his bride Lisa co-host More to Life on EWTN Radio. They also are the producers of Catholic HOM, Households on Mission. Find out more about CatholicCounselors.com and Catholic Households on Mission, and let's beat this mental health crisis with sound research and the faith. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
This program is brought to you in part by Dave Tyson with Real Estate for Life, a faith-based organization, and Texana Bank, offering residential mortgage assistance across all 50 states, including purchases and refinances with conventional FHA and VA loans. More information can be found at re4l.org. Again, that's re4l.org.
All loans subject to credit approval. Texana Bank, NMLS 407536. Equal housing lender. Member FDIC.
Ave Maria School of Law is the Roman Catholic law school in the United States. Consistently ranked in the Princeton Review as one of the best and most conservative law schools, as well as pre-law's most devout law school. Ave Maria School of Law provides a traditional legal education while emphasizing how the law intersects with the Catholic intellectual tradition and natural law philosophy. Ave Maria School of Law, unabashedly Catholic, consistently excellent. For more information, visit avemarialaw.edu.
This program brought to you in part by Ave Maria Florida, a big kind of small town where golf carts take you everywhere and there's always something fun around the corner. Discover championship golf, resort-style amenities, and a town center full of shopping and dining. With Ave Maria University and Ave Maria Catholic Church at its heart, it's a community full of connection and charm. More than 25 model homes are available for viewing. More information can be found at avemaria.com. That's avemaria.com.
When the need for senior care arises, home is where the heart is. Visiting Angels provides home care for mom or dad up to 24 hours per day, including personal care, meals, and light housework. You may select your professional caregiver with Visiting Angels. More information at visitingangels.com or at 877-374-LIVE. That's 877-374-LIVE. Visiting Angels, America's choice in senior home care.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. I've been thinking a lot about the Lindsey Graham case, but following it to some degree at the very least, and I wanted to address some of the issues in virtue that we are seeing, especially amongst Christians, who are rightly outraged and concerned about the issue. So as far as we know things about the trial, Lindsey Clancy has admitted that she killed her three children. The central legal question now is her state of mind, not so much whether or not she committed the crime. Now, the internet, unfortunately, has predictably decided that reality requires a more exciting twist. And we're seeing that all over social media. In fact, within only a few days, social media transformed this devastating family tragedy into another season of crowdsourced detective fiction. And frankly, I get really perturbed by this. Millions of strangers suddenly convinced that they possess the investigative abilities that are greater than the police or detectives or forensic experts, prosecutors, defense attorneys, jurors, you name it. All of these people who have devoted years of their lives to become experts on those fields. That confidence would impress me if it were grounded in evidence. This phenomenon has a name. Criminologists and media scholars call it forensic fandom. Some people also describe it as internet sleuthing or true crime parasociality. But the phenomenon is simple. This is what it is. Ordinary people who've consumed thousands of hours of crime content in entertainment or true crime stories until they gradually begin imagining themselves as expert participants and investigators, not mere observers. So now every photograph they see, it's a new clue that investigators miss, but they caught. Or every facial expression is new evidence. Every pause during the testimony, that's new proof of deception. Every unrelated detail is now part of an elaborate web of conspiracy that somehow every investigator has not picked up, except us, of course. We figured out what others simply couldn't. And the problem is social media rewards this behavior because outrage produces attention, attention produces clicks, and clicks produce money. That economic incentive is more of a driving force than most conspiracy theorists will ever admit. Boston University media scholar Catherine Caduto, she observed that true crime audiences desperately seek really clean narratives, in air quotes, even though real tragedies don't always have really clean narratives. And so she warns, social media creators frequently monetize sensational speculation. But they also forget that these cases involve actual human beings with real human lives that have already been shattered. Margaret McLean, formerly served as a prosecutor, similarly described much of the online commentary surrounding this trial with one simple word, clickbait. Human psychology has a few things to share with us. Psychology has long described something called the just world hypothesis. So Melvin Lerner, he argued that people possess a deep desire to believe that good things happen to good people and terrible things only happen to bad people, deserving people. And so cases like Lindsay Clancy is psychologically unbearable, just like the Charlie Kirk situation. They're psychologically unbearable because they expose a frightening truth about human frailty, that if you don't have God as the final recourse for all injustice, then you suddenly realize that, well, injustice happens and you don't have an answer for it. And so now a loving mother who sought psychiatric treatment and repeatedly searched for help before committing an unimaginable crime just jars the comfortable psyches that evil always announces itself with obvious warning signs, or so we subconsciously believe. And so many people instinctively search for conspiratorial explanations because those are neater and more satisfying. Perhaps the husband secretly committed the murders. Perhaps the police are covering everything up. Perhaps the prosecutors are deliberately framing an innocent woman. Perhaps everyone, except anonymous TikTok investigators, missed the obvious. Perhaps those theories will satisfy emotional desires. Well, no. The facts are painful and unsatisfying, and that's okay. The facts are stubborn things. Patrick Clancy has never been charged with any crime connected to the deaths of his children. Prosecutors have never alleged that he participated in the killings. Lindsay Clancy herself admitted to the act. The dispute before the jury is about criminal responsibility through an insanity defense, not the factual responsibility for the deaths. None of those realities have prevented countless online commentators from constructing elaborate narratives built upon clothing choices and body language and voice tone in the 911 call and remarriage and relocation and facial microexpressions, as if we're all experts at these things. And that speculation reveals far more about our modern digital culture than it does about Patrick Clancy. I've already heard horrifying conspiracy theories accusing this grieving father, despite an abject absence of evidence supporting those accusations. Every few hours, another viral video will be dropped and will promise to unveil hidden evidence that investigators did not pick up, but they did. Every thumbnail promises shocking revelation. Every content creator is now promising knowledge that, not even the lawyers know this case, know this fact. And eventually, every one of those theories can't hold water. They all contradict each other after a certain point. Fantasy exhausts itself. And that pattern goes beyond this trial. I don't like talking about her a lot, but this is how Candace Owens became enormously influential. She mastered the economics of digital certainty. See, numerous internet personalities have discovered the same formula, so it's not just her. It's that she monetized it the best. Present yourself as the only courageous voice willing to expose quote-unquote hidden truths in a network of information gathering that nobody else has. Reject whatever ordinary evidence, whatever the institutional narrative is, even when it's logically coherent, reject it outright. And then promise secret knowledge that's unavailable anywhere else. Reward audiences with a sense of moral satisfaction in the self, a sense of righteous indignation, and then repeat that cycle indefinitely. That strategy creates an impressive amount of social media traffic, but it doesn't have lasting credibility. We've seen this throughout history. Conspiracy thinking scratches a righteous itch for a little while because it offers believers the intoxicating experience of belonging to an enlightened minority. There's a name for this. It's called Gnosticism. But that satisfaction quickly evaporates because every solved conspiracy requires another conspiracy. You wind up exhausting the first one. And so every exposed villain means that now you have to find another hidden villain. Every explanation, now you have to find another mystery that's unanswered. And so the believer, after a while, gets exhausted because they're increasingly suspicious. But then some people hold on. they become increasingly dependent upon fresh speculation because there's a kind of emotional satisfaction there. G.K. Chesterton understood something about this, and he said, "The object of opening up the mind is to shut it again on something solid. The problem with endless speculation is it goes everywhere and arrives nowhere. You live in perpetual doubt, and so the mind creates a prison for itself." And social media intensifies that. It's a very unhealthy instinct, because fallen human nature tends to this. And the algorithms, they reward this kind of emotional intensity. Careful judgment, prudence, well, that doesn't sell very well by algorithmic standards. Viral success belongs frequently to confident storytellers, not people who carefully and diligently seek the truth. And so thousands of ordinary users begin believing that if you possess internet access, you now are qualified to reconstruct complex homicide conspiracy theories from video clips that you have garnered in the last 30 seconds. Scripture warns us against all this. The book of Proverbs teaches us, the one who states his case first seems right until the other comes and examines him. Wouldn't it be wonderful if every single social media influencer were to meditate on Proverbs 18:17? Christ himself likewise warned us against rash judgment. When he said, "Judge not lest ye be judged," he wasn't saying that we cannot criticize sin. He was saying to be careful with the way in which we exercise our capacity for judgment. Jesus wants us to practice sound moral reasoning. But we are to prohibited from prideful, arrogant certainty regarding matters that are beyond our knowledge. None of us knows the full details of this particular case, the Lindsay Clancy case. None of us sat through the psychiatric consultation or the medical records. But instead, all we have is the fact that Patrick and Lindsay lost three children. Lindsay faces consequences beyond anything most people can imagine. So this is the Christian call. Pray for Lindsay and Patrick. Pray for the children who've passed, pray for the jurors, pray for the physicians, and let's guide our intellects in virtue to seek the objective truth. I'm Marcus Peter.
You like pizza? Me too. And for that, we can thank our friend, Tom Monahan. First, he starts with $900 and opens one pizza shop. Then it's worldwide, thousands of shops. But all this was just a warm-up for his greatest achievement yet. He built a university.
God inspired Tom to build up generations of men and women who have a hunger to reach the world for Christ. This place is Ave Maria University.
Visit avemaria.edu to see what's next.
Ave Maria in the Afternoon is underwritten by the following nonprofit organization: Real Estate for Life. Buying or selling your home or business property? Real Estate for Life can connect you with one of 1,400 pro-life real estate agents around the world. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 70% to Ave Maria Radio and Human Life International. More information at realestateforlife.org or 877-LIFE-US1. That's realestateforlife.org.
The wisdom of Mother Angelica.
I said to the sisters one day, "What do you think you're going to look like in heaven?" Oh, some of them had absolutely magnificent ideas. I didn't think of one of them. And so I got desperate because then my turn came. I didn't know what to say. And so in desperation, I said, "What do you think I'll wear in heaven?" And they all said with one voice, "Armor!"
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic.
Do you own popular index mutual funds or ETFs? If so, you're automatically owned shares of companies that conflict with your moral beliefs. Ave Maria Mutual Funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors can invest in the no-load Ave Maria Mutual Funds. The experienced professional portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and pro-life values. You can learn more about Ave Maria Mutual Funds today at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
Father Benedict Rochelle.
I must tell you that from what I observe from very young people, all of these blasphemers, all of these mockers are in for a tough time. Because the devil bites his own tail. And I find among young people a growing reverence and longing for God. I find a decline in the cynicism and skepticism around, because it had to destroy itself. No one can live on being an enemy of God. It's too crazy. It's too absurd. It's too dark. It's too bleak. God is beautiful. God is holy. Why in the world mock God?
The people you know and trust are on EWTN.
Christ is the answer with Father John Ricardo.
He always starts with the good things. You know, the seven letters to the churches and the book of Revelation is a great way to write letters to other people, by the way, or to have conversations with other people. You start with what's going well. You do this, this, and this really well. I love it. Thank you. Here's what you're lacking. And I think for many of us as men, what the Lord's communicating at that second part of the letter or the second part of the conversation is, here's what we're lacking. You don't ever spend enough time with me. You have no idea what I'm trying to offer you in the gift of my friendship. Or if you do, you don't make time for it. And if you would but come to me, I would change your life like that. But you don't come. Not with the regularity that I want you to come. Not with the ardor and the fervor and the passion that I want you to come. I have a hunch, like more than a hunch, that's what he says to me. And I got a hunch that's what he would say to many of us.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. Given that in the past few years we've seen a rise in concern, particularly in the Middle East, I wanted to talk about a new piece that I saw in Catholic World Report, and this is from David Penault. It's entitled Islamic Persecution, Christian Survival, and Encountering the Houthis in Yemen. David is the author of Earth Dragon Run, a spiritual entertainment. His other publications include The Crucifix on Mecca's Front Porch, A Christian Companion for the Study of Islam, and the novel Providence Blue, A Fantasy Quest, all published by Ignatius Press. He's also an emeritus professor of religious studies at Santa Clara University. David, it's great to speak with you again. How are you?
Thank you so much, Marcus. It's a privilege to be back with you again.
Yeah, it's been a while, and I remember our conversations very fondly, and frankly, because there's a tremendous amount of insight in there. And the last time we spoke about the crucifix on Mecca's front porch, I want to just give you a bit of the space to share about Earth Dragon Run so that people can hear about your book.
Well, thank you so much. Yes, this is a novel that was recently published, as you mentioned, by Ignatius Press, and it's based on a volunteer rescue work that my wife Jody and I have been doing in recent years, both in South Africa and in Southeast Asia, rescuing various endangered animals. And one of the things that I highlight in that novel is the fact that much of the wildlife animal trafficking throughout the world is finding its market in communist China. And a lot of the novel concerns the various ways in which communist China is truly a destructive force throughout the world. And in the course of doing that volunteer work, we also came upon a number of links to communist Chinese persecution of Christians in China. And all of that is covered in the novel Earth Dragon Run.
I thank you so much for penning that book, and I'm looking forward to reading it myself. But to go back to what I was talking about something you recently wrote for Catholic World Report, I want to ask you to share the story here that you're narrating in this article.
Yes. So this is a piece that was just published something like yesterday in Catholic World Report, and I want to thank you for spotting it so quickly and having me on the air. That's a 24-hour turnaround. That's pretty good. Yeah. Yes, so listeners may know already that in my capacity as a professor of religious studies at Santa Clara University, I served for many years as the founding director of the university's program in Arabic, Islamic, and Middle Eastern studies. And in my capacity as director, I did a lot of work in various countries throughout the Islamic world. The piece published yesterday is sort of a retrospective having to do with work I did some years ago in Sana'a. Sana'a is the capital city of Yemen. And given everything that's been going on, obviously, in recent days, in the Persian Gulf, in the Red Sea, the Bab al-Mandab and so forth, and the Houthis. I want to share with readers experiences of mine from some years ago in which I had the unusual opportunity of meeting with and interviewing various representatives of the Houthi militant movement. And so in that article that was just published in Catholic World Report, I talk about my meeting, various meetings I had with the Houthis, interviewing them and, you know, hearing directly from them about their worldview, and then also talking about the status of persecuted Christians under Houthi rule, which I knew that readers of Catholic World Report would be interested in, and then offered some viewpoints about prospects looking forward in terms of things like how the United States might possibly deal with the challenge that we face, both in dealing with the Houthis in Yemen and their sponsors and de facto allies in the Islamic Republic of Iran.
How did you procure that meeting with Yahya Saifallah?
This was a rather circuitous path. And of course, this, first of all, I should note for listeners' benefit that, as I point out in the article, I was fortunate to be there some years ago during a lull in the recurrent civil wars that have been going on for some decades, really, in Yemen. So that was the first thing, that there was a moment of relative calm. And then what I did was reach out to everyone I knew through my own connections professionally who had ever done work in Yemen, and I met with a number of Yemenis here in the United States. And through those contacts, before I ever arrived, I was able to begin to set up some, you know, connections, introductions. And it was a very, very good thing that I did so, because the fact that even then, during the lull in the fighting, Yemen doesn't exactly host a lot of foreigners, especially American Catholic Christians. And I'll tell you that, for example, when I flew, flying from the United States, I flew into Frankfurt. There's obviously no direct flight, even from Europe, into Yemen. So I had to fly to Addis Ababa in Ethiopia. The Airbus that I was flying on was full flying into Addis Ababa. But then when it then took off from Addis Ababa to Sana'a, to the capital of Yemen, I counted a total of, I think, 14 people on the entire giant Airbus, and I was the only foreigner. And when I arrived, it was in the middle of the night. There was only one other plane on the tarmac. Everything was dark. It was around midnight, and the security guards and everything were bored. They had no one else to entertain them but me. Fortunately, since I speak Arabic, I was able to, you know, explain what I was doing, and I had arranged for someone from the guest house with the wonderful name the Arabia Felix to pick me up, and that was my sort of base of operations. And then from there, I was able to work with the leads that I had and begin to establish a network of interviews and conversations. And it was a challenge, but I learned a tremendous amount, and that's what I report on in that article.
Now, to go a little deeper, given that you did have these exchanges with the Houthis, I want to ask you to share what, for example, what was the Houthi slogan, especially when they learned that you were from the United States?
Yes. So I mentioned this in the article I'm always frank about this, because people I meet with and work with in Islamic countries, they'll always ask you within 5 minutes, you know, what religion are you? So I tell them Catholic Christian, you know, mm-hmm. and on top of that, you know, I'm an American, you know. And so he right away recited the Houthi slogan, you know, Allah is great. Death to America and Israel. May the Jews be cursed. Victory belongs to Islam, you know. And I took a chance. I sort of pressed the point, and I instantly said to him, you know, this business of El Maut de America, you know, death, you know, death to America, you know, the Houthi slogan, you know, that kind of reminds me of, you know, what I've heard in Farsi, in Persian, Mar Bar America, you know, death to America, which you hear all the time, right up to today. You know, going back, you know, to the original Islamic Revolution back in 79.
Yeah, the Ayatollah.
Death to America, you know, under the Ayatollahs in Iran. And I said to him, oh, so are you people subordinates, underlings of the Iranians? And so that is interesting. Yahya's the Houthi I was talking to, his colleagues kind of upset, but he kept his cool and then explains to me in detail, rather patiently, he gives me sort of an overview of the distinction between the Houthis and their form of Islam and the Iranian form of Shiism. And I'll just mention that both the Houthis and the Iranians follow forms of Shia Islam.
Right. Let's pause right there, David. I'm talking with David Pinault, author of Earth, Dragon, Run. We're talking about his encounter with Houthi Muslims and what to think about this in light of our civilization today. Continuing on the other side, I'm Marcus Peter.
Brought to you by the nonprofit Seton Home Study.
Hi, everybody. Dr. Ray Guarendi here. You want to pass the Catholic faith on to your children? A very good way is to teach your children at home. You want to protect your kids from the toxic culture that surrounds us? Do you want to have a greater influence in what your kids are learning? Once more, a great way is to teach your children at home. No teacher is going to care about your kids as much as you do. Seton Home Study School is the best way to teach your children at home. Go to setonhome.org. setonhome.org.
This Ave Maria program brought to you in part by the following nonprofit.
One of the greatest threats to your family isn't a disaster or a virus, but addiction. In nearly every family and every pew, someone is silently struggling. Beginning July 11th, Shalom World TV and the iThirst Initiative present Unshackled, a powerful new series on the Catholic Church's response to the addiction crisis, bringing together leading voices to discuss real healing. Stream it free at shalomworld.org or on the Shalom World app today.
Life is hard and we have to struggle against so much, including the ongoing struggle against our own sinfulness. And sometimes we just want to say, no more, I'm done. But God isn't done with you. I'm Dr. Marcus Peter, and in my book, Not Finished Yet, I can show you how God has already begun a wondrous work in you, in each of us, and only needs your cooperation. Find Not Finished Yet and all of our other books on the store page at AveMariaRadio.net. That's AveMariaRadio.net.
This program is brought to you by the following nonprofit underwriter.
Are you longing to hear God's voice? Lord, Teach Me to Pray, the free Ignatian Prayer Series will open your heart to His voice, to the peace you are seeking and the only love that fulfills the human heart, Jesus. God is calling you to true joy, knowing Jesus personally. Lord, Teach Me to Pray is free. Go to LordTeachMeToPray.com, click on the red box, order the Lord, Teach Me to Pray series now. Go to LordTeachMeToPray.com.
The Heart of the Interior Life with Elizabeth Jangle.
In Rule 2 of St. Ignatius of Loyola's teaching on the discernment of spirits, he describes the characteristics of a person whose fundamental spiritual direction of their lives is directed towards God. He writes, "In persons who are going on intensely purifying their sins and rising from good to better in the service of God our Lord." St. Ignatius is describing persons who love God intensely and want to live their lives in conformity to His will. These persons frequent the sacrament of reconciliation, sin is being uprooted, and virtue is flourishing. They are striving to grow in holiness and are giving more of their time to the service of the Lord. With attentive care to the spiritual life, the person portrayed in Rule 2 is the image of the growing and maturing Christian. Is there an area in your life that needs to rise from good to better? Grace awaits.
For more information, visit AveMariaRadio.net.
Who is responsible for the death of Jesus? The Catholic Catechism emphatically states that neither the Jews of Jesus' time nor the Jews of our time should be considered rejected or accursed as a consequence of the Lord's Passion. Not all the Jews in the religious hierarchy were opposed to him. Nicodemus and Joseph of Arimathea were two prominent men who were secret disciples. The Acts of the Apostles notes that many priests were obedient to the faith, and some belonged to the party of the Pharisees. St. James reported to St. Paul that many thousands believed in the Lord and were also zealous for the law. The religious authorities were not in unanimity as to what to do with Jesus. The Pharisees threatened excommunication to his followers. The Sanhedrin, having declared him a blasphemer, but without power to execute, turned him over to the Romans as a political anarchist. The Catechism cautions we must leave judgment as to the participants in Jesus' trial to God alone. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
Good afternoon, and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. Talking with David Pinault, author most recently of Earth Dragon Run, a spiritual entertainment, published by Ignatius Press. And we are talking about his newest piece in Catholic World Report, about his encounter with the Houthi Muslims in Yemen. So, David, you were just talking about how if you compare the Iranian Muslims to the Houthis, there's a different kind of history, even though they share similar creeds pertaining to Christianity and the Jews and the West in general.
Yes, this is fascinating to me, and it was quite an education. The Houthis are, I would say, a militantly and politically organized branch of a form of Shiism known as the Zaydis, named after Zayd Ibn Ali, who was one of the Shia imams or spiritual leaders in the 8th century. And in so the Yemeni tradition of Shiism is one that patterns itself after the political and spiritual behavior of this figure, Zayd ibn Ali. And Zayd is remembered today for the fact that he devoted his life and was killed in the process of what the Arabs call muqawama, or active resistance against unjust tyrannical overlords. And whereas the form of Shia Islam in Iran up until 1979 was largely characterized by what I would call political quietism, that is, keeping a low profile, and because the Shias historically have always been in the minority, the idea is to await the coming of the Mehdi, the figure who will basically usher in the end of time and purge the earth of injustice. And so in 1979, with the Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, that changed in Iran, where instead of this quietist staying out of the spotlight attitude, instead the form of Shiism in Iran moved to direct political confrontation and what they call exporting the Islamic Revolution. Now, today, if you think of a Shia country, most people think instantly of Iran. And, of course, the Iranians, Tehran is providing a great deal of military support to the Houthis because the Houthis occupy a strategic location. They have next door neighbors to the north in Saudi Arabia, and which has been at odds with both Iran and the Houthis. But the Houthis also occupy critical geostrategic territory on the coast of the Red Sea, and also directly opposite, right opposite the Bab el-Mandeb, the so-called Gate of Lamentation. That's the very narrow strait. It's only about 18 miles wide, separating Arabia from Africa. And so the thing that was very interesting in my interviews with the Houthis is when I suggested to them, well, so are you basically subordinate to the Iranians? It turns out the Houthis are very, very sensitive to that topic. And they said, no, we were militants centuries before the Iranians. The Iranians came in late to the game,
Yeah, effectively.
So we're the ones who inspired them, And I sort of mentally filed that away, and I note that in the article because of the fact that ostensibly, the Houthis and the Iranians are good friends, but I refer to it more as kind of an alliance of convenience. The Houthis are very, very sensitive to this notion of their own independence. And I think that that's something for us to keep in mind in any, future, dealings with the Houthis, If it's not possible to invade, and I talk about this in the article, I don't think we're going to be bringing in ground troops, and I mention that the terrain in Yemen, I have some familiarity with this, it's the area under the control of the Houthis, especially along the coast and the central highlands and the northern provinces, very, very mountainous. And I mentioned how some listeners, if they know Middle Eastern history at all, may recognize the name of Gamal Abdel Nasser, who was president of Egypt in the 1960s, 1950s and 1960s. And in 1962, in the name of expanding, you know, al-Watan al-Arabi, or the Arab nation, you know, this notion of pan-Arab unity, he tried to intervene in civil wars in Yemen and sent many, many thousands of Egyptian troops to fight against the Houthis, against the whole Yemeni movement in the north, is sort of the predecessor to the Houthis. And it was a disaster. Oh, well over 15,000 Egyptian troops were killed. And in the end, Nasser had to withdraw the Egyptian troops, and then it became known as Nasser's Vietnam. Mm-hmm. So I don't think we're about to, you know, repeat that effort. And so that's why one of the things that I do in this article that just came out with Catholic World Report is to look at, okay, are there any sort of diplomatic entry points. And that's the reason why in my article I say that I think it would be a very good idea for the United States to consider reactivating funding for groups like the Voice of America that do regional, local language broadcasts in languages like Arabic and Persian and so forth, you know, in the Middle East, to, you know, begin to see if it's possible to make contact with local populations, because as I note in the article, the Houthi government shares in common with the theocracy in Iran that both of them are very brutal towards their own populations. And from what I've seen, you know, actually much of the local population under the control of the Houthis are very dissatisfied with them. And I think it would be good for us to see if there's any way of making contact with that discontent.
It's funny, the Persian, the Iranian brand of Shiite Islam mirrors quite a bit of Mormonism, the especially the 12-word doctrine and the belief in the immortality of the 12th of the Imams.
Mm-hmm. Yes. One of the things that's absolutely fascinating is that according to what's called 12-er Shiism, which predominates in Iran, according to Shia belief in Iran, the 12th Imam, who is in the lineage of the Prophet Muhammad via his daughter Fatima and his son-in-law Ali ibn Abi Talib, the 12th Imam went into what's called ghaiba, or occultation. That is, when he was about to be assassinated by malicious Sunnis, that Allah, that God, took him into sort of a protective hiding. And so this is supposed to have happened in the 10th century. And so from that day until today, according to 12-er Shia belief, the 12th Imam is still alive, but in occultation, in hiding, and then will come back someday, basically to inaugurate Armageddon, to purge the earth of injustice. And this is a belief that has shaped a lot of the theologically confrontational ideology in groups like the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps that currently has more and more predominance in Iran today.
Before we continue talking about potential policy in terms of U.S. relationships with the different Islamic nations in the Middle East, let's also address just how ignorant we are here in the United States as citizens about the beliefs of Islamic groups, Islamic nations, their perception of the West, of Christianity, of Christian Judeo-Christianity in general, and therefore a certain kind of recognition that there is an incompatible hostility to Western civilizational heritage with the reality of textual Islam.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There are many, many things that we can say on this, and I'm glad, Marcus, that you brought this up. one of the points that I try to make in my book, The Crucifix on Mecca's Front Porch, A Christian's Companion for the Study of Islam, is that, in my opinion at least, as someone who has worked overseas and also has taught courses on Islam and world religions here in the States, there's an unfortunate tendency for many well-meaning Christians to bend over backwards to try to find points of theological rapprochement between Christianity and Islam. And in that book, The Crucifix on Mecca's Front Porch, I talk about an experience that I often went through when I would take my students on field trips to local places of worship. I've taught courses on Islam and world religions in the East Coast and the Midwest and on the West Coast in California. And consistently what would happen so often is I would have no difficulty at all taking students, say, to Hindu temples, Buddha shrines, Jain, Sikh, you name it, you know. There was a special challenge with regard to Islam because of the fact that it was very hard for the imams, the you know, the prayer leaders, it was very hard for them to resist the temptation to proselytize my students, even though I'd explained in advance that, you know, you know, this was you know, an academic scholarly enterprise, and they would say, yeah, we get that, you know. But then when the students would arrive, they would start to say, you know, actually, you know, we Muslims have so much in common with you. You know, we venerate Jesus, too. Jesus appears in the Quran, you know. Jesus we revere as a prophet, you know, and we also revere the Blessed Virgin Mary. Now, that's true as far as it goes, but as I point out in the book, Islam and the Quran, their sacred scripture, denies that Jesus is the Son of God, denies that he's a member of the Trinity, and denies that he was ever crucified on the cross. So the whole notion of salvation through the self-gift of Christ as an act of love, that's completely missing from Islam. And it's important.
So we're going to have to stop there, David. I've been talking with David Pinault, and he's been sharing with us about his encounters with Houthi Muslims and therefore how U.S. relationships ought to continue with Islamic nations. I'm Marcus Peter.